not trying to be the star of the day, not trying to like do anything really special, but just be sort of solid and dependable and earn your kind of right to be there. But just be polite and be kind and give people as much time as you can. I think that's really important. And that's something that people remember for years. You know, and if you have a time where you haven't got so many gigs, things don't normally change overnight. It's about changing what you're doing behind the scenes. And then over a period of 3 or 6 months, you kind of grow again and you try and get back to the position you were maybe a year ago. If you hear someone else doing something, that should inspire you to do something different, not just to say, oh, that's a good idea, I'll copy it.
Okay, so yeah, thanks for taking the time.
No, it's good to be here.
Out of your busy schedule, how are you? How was your day so far?
It was good. I've been working in the studio and some admin stuff, and then a new mix from me went online 1 or 2 hours ago. So I think it's my first mix since October or something like that. So yeah, it's nice to put that up, and it's too early to see how well it will do, but it's nice to get something new online.
Sure. We will definitely link it in the descriptions.
Okay, thank you.
Of our conversation.
Yeah, it's the latest thing on my SoundCloud. Yeah.
Great. You mentioned you will see how it will do. What is your general estimation of saying that something is successful or not as an output?
In terms of metrics, it's hard to tell because obviously it's a mix. Obviously, the initial thing is SoundCloud plays, SoundCloud shares and comments and the kind of engagement there. But also just how it does on social media. Sometimes it does well everywhere. Sometimes one platform does a lot better than others. Or sometimes you can have a mix that doesn't particularly get as many plays as you expected. But then if one promoter says, hey, I heard the mix, it's great, I'd like you to play at my event, then that's a win. You know, that's great. You know, so even if there's a million different ways you can kind of judge something. So I guess that's also a safety net, because then you can say, okay, it might not have done well here, but it was a success here. So it's kind of like it means you don't get to that kind of point where, okay, it didn't do as well as I expected everywhere. But sometimes people will just come up to your gigs and say they love a mix or something like that, or you get a comment about it a year later. So yeah, my main thing is really you have to put these things out there and see, and they take on a life of their own. The only way something's going to fail is if you don't do it. If you just sit back and, you know, if you get too worried about putting something online because you're worried about its reaction, then you're never going to get anything done.
Mm. And do you also have, let's say, after these years in your career, do you still have some fear, quote unquote, or doubt before you release something, whether that's a mix or that's new releases or remixes?
No, I'm not too, I don't want to say I'm not too bothered, because I do care, and I do monitor sales statistics and streaming statistics, DJ reactions, things like this. But no, I'm not nervous about it. There's definitely releases that I'm more sort of, I expect more from, I'm maybe more confident in, because they feature high profile artists, or the track has been building up a little bit of momentum when people have played it before the release date. But no, yeah, I with Per Tracks, I never, you know, do something that's going to be risky in terms of financially. Like if I know something's going to cost a certain amount of money, that money is already in the bank. It's not like, you know, some people will release a record, and if the record doesn't sell, they have no way to pay for the manufacturing. It's like running a nightclub event and not having enough money to pay the DJs until the people start coming through the door and paying. And, you know, that's a very risky way to run a business. So like anything that Per Tracks is going to do, anything that it's going to have to commit to in the future financially, I always make sure there's enough money there for it. So even if the record sells nothing, you know, the manufacturing will still be paid for, and everything will be okay, and you can rebuild rather than going into debt and ripping people off. Yeah.
Okay, nice. And if I understand correctly, you are running Perk Tracks yourself, or is this like a big team behind it?
No, there's nothing behind me. No, it's just me, really. Different people help me, obviously with skills I don't have. Like some releases will be promoted by PR agencies. Obviously things like graphic design, mastering, you know, these are things that are outside of my skill set. And But the general day-to-day running of the label, the administration, royalty statements, A&R, finding music, commissioning, the graphic designers, video makers, that's all me. And running things like the Bandcamp and the social media. Yeah.
So still sounds like a big workload of and responsibility. And how many tracks are released, let's say, per year?
Well, it depends year to year. Last year was pretty quiet, three releases, but one was an album, so about 15, 16 tracks in total. But this year is going to be a lot busier. I'm expecting 7 or 8 releases. So, yeah, I don't know. It's not so much the amount of music, it's just the amount of releases, because every release needs a separate, like, it's boring stuff like metadata sheets, setting up the DJ promo page, the Bandcamp pages. So, yeah, it's a lot of work. But I find a way to do it, and I'm always working. It's very rare that I have a day off where I just do nothing. So that every day I do something, and every day I do a few hours in the studio or running the label. You have to keep on top of it.
That's also something I wanted to ask you. How does your week look like? Because I could ask, like, what does your day look like? But as a touring DJ, I guess your second half of the week is pretty different than the first one. So how do you structure your flow?
Well, if you kind of think of a week, for me, I would think the week kind of begins almost on, like, I play the last gig of the weekend is normally on a Saturday night. So I'll come home on the Sunday, try and rest a bit on the Sunday night so I'm fresh to start on Monday. Like, it might be a bit later than normal, but maybe like 10 or 11 in the morning on a Monday. And then, it's just work as much as I can. Generally, it's always been administration, emails, financial things in the morning. And then more creative things, making music, going through demos and submissions. That's normally in the afternoon and the evening. And then, as we get closer towards the weekend, I start thinking more about what new music I'm going to play at the weekend. If there's anything of my own that I want to try and finish off, make a rough version to test out. So through the week, my brain kind of goes from label back into sort of DJ mode. And then Thursday is normally devoted to getting ready for the weekend. And also the boring stuff like checking the schedules for the weekend, checking in for flights, just making sure everything's in place so that weekend goes smoothly.
And how deep into the weekend do you prefer to get all of your itineraries for the travel?
Well, my agency Elite has like an online kind of portal. So I have my own area when each DJ can look at their own particular diary and their gigs. And so generally information just slowly gets put into that. So there's a page for every booking. Obviously, once the booking's confirmed, the booking appears in my schedule. And then, things like, the hotel or the set time or the flight, they just slowly get added as these bits of information are confirmed. But I keep an eye on it and I just make sure everything's okay. And I get to approve flights. For a particular gig, if I want to leave early in the morning and have a bit more time in the city, or if I want to get there quite late and just kind of get off the plane, freshen up and play the gig. So the choice is there. But I some DJs are kind of don't want to see that stuff through the week and they just look at it maybe Thursday or Friday night. But I'm more of a sort of control freak and I'm always keeping an eye on things and how they progress.
Because also I'm working on an agency side of the music industry. I do advancing and logistics and like some booking assistance. Just for a little bit of context. I also worked with, I suppose you know, Fraser.
Yeah.
I did for a few months. I also did his stuff.
Okay, cool. Yeah, cool. So you understand all the kind of it's like tiny little cogs that make a booking work. Yeah.
So that's why I asked, because I also had artists who wanted to check all of their flights and all of their details, let's say 3 weeks before, and some didn't bother up until let's say Thursday afternoon. They have to take, two pair of underwear, two pair of socks, and then off we go, as long as stuff were booked.
Yeah, I used to know a DJ that was so focused on the studio and being creative. And this was a sort of where social media wasn't such a big thing, so artists weren't expected to help promote events so much. It was just down to the promoter to promote the event. And they would look on Thursday night at where they were going to be the next day. So they would sometimes have no idea. And it could be somewhere, 1 hour from their house, or it could be the other side of the world. And they would look on the Thursday night and then pack what the kind of clothes and things they need for that trip. But for my brain, that would drive me mad. I need to know what I'm doing and have a sort of a better overall picture of how things are for me.
I can imagine. And with that schedule, busy as it is, have you ever had a morning where you woke up and you didn't know in which city you were?
Yeah, you get that a lot. That thing, like I always try and get some sleep between gigs just to kind of psychologically put a break between the 2 days. So one day doesn't just become the next day. If you have 2 hours sleep, then of course the alarm goes off maybe half an hour before you're meant to be picked up. And you look around and it's a hotel room and it's a bit confusing. Yeah, it happens sometimes. And even if I wake up at home, my brain is thinking, am I playing a gig today? Am I traveling? Do I have something in London? The first few things you think of is, what do I have to do? And it's quite nice those days where it's just, okay, get up, make some tea. Yeah, just do the day at my own pace rather than having something scheduled. But yeah, it can get confusing, especially if you do 3 or 4 gigs in a row. Then after a bit, it gets a bit much because you're waking up in a strange city and you're also very tired. So the two things become quite confusing.
And what did you learn through these years of touring? Let's say, what are 2 biggest lessons that you learned?
Firstly, I think just kind of give your all to everything. And that means with people, just be polite, be kind, whether it's the promoter of the biggest festival in the world that you want to make a good impression to him, or it's to someone that's saved up and comes to your gig and there's nothing they can offer back to you. It's not like they're going to book you somewhere or help you with your career. Just be polite and be kind and give people as much time as you can. I think that's really important. And that's something that people remember for years to come. People write to me and they say, oh, last time you were in my country 5 years ago, we spoke for 2 minutes. And I might not remember this exact interaction, but they remember it and they want to do it again. So that's really important. And the second thing really, I think, for gigging is just really stop. It sounds a bit kind of hippie, but just kind of go on your own path and do your own thing. And there'll be years where you're busier. There'll be years where you're not so busy. It doesn't mean your career is over. It just means, things go up and down. It depends if you follow trends or you're just trying to sort of stay true to what music you do. But yeah, just be yourself. Don't go online and say, oh, that DJ that, a few years ago I thought was, just starting off and now they're huge. And I feel like my career has stopped. Stop going forward or maybe even going backwards. Yeah, just do your own thing and be yourself and not compare yourself to other people, because there's always going to be people that blow up and there's other people whose careers could be slowing down a bit for a million different reasons, whether it's musical or professional or even personal reasons. So yeah, just be yourself and focus on your own kind of journey. And as long as you're happy with what you're doing, then it doesn't really matter what other people are doing.
And was there ever a time in your career where you didn't follow this advice or this lesson that you then had to learn, let's say, the hard way?
Yeah, because it's when you're really busy with gigs, it's much more easy to think, even if there's things happening, say a musical trend or a style of music becomes popular and you don't like that. If you're doing well, then you're like, oh, I don't care about that stuff because I'm doing well. I'm staying true to myself and I've got a busy schedule. But if you have a few months with less gigs, which happens to all of us from time to time, then you start looking at other people. You think, oh, how, this music that I really hate is becoming huge. And it starts to kind of eat away and you start to question yourself. Am I making the right music? Am I promoting myself in the right way? And second guessing yourself is really the beginning of the end, because at that point, you're just going to make quick decisions that where you're not being true to yourself. You'll follow what other people are doing. But if someone releases a record, that's maybe a record they've been working on a year ago and it's taken time to be manufactured and promoted. So if you're copying what someone releases now, you're already a year behind what that person's doing now. So you can't, to look at other people, whether creatively and what they're doing or the amount of gigs they're playing, the kind of events they're playing at, it's really self-destructive. It's not going to get you anywhere.
It's like chasing the sunset. There's always another hill. That's always something that's after that.
There's always going to be another DJ who's younger than you. You think better, busier than you, better than you, whatever. you know, there's always going to be someone you can compare yourself to and get down about yourself. But no, you just have to do the best you can. Staying true to yourself, even if it means occasionally you might have months that are a bit quieter for gigs, in the long term, it's just a much better strategy for your career and I think also for your mental health. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the challenges that you would say artists, let's say 5 or 10 years ago, didn't face that the artists today are facing?
I think, I'm not sure if it's true that there's more DJs than ever. I think there is. I think there's more DJs than ever. And social media makes you feel like there's more DJs than ever. Because years ago on social media, you really only saw content from people you followed. Now, obviously, you get the feeds, you get these kind of suggestion pages, up the sort of page with all the different things on Instagram, or the way Facebook feeds have changed over the last few days. It's pushing content from accounts you don't follow into your feed. So therefore, you're seeing people, and as we know, social media is very fake. It's people presenting an idealized version of their kind of lives. So yeah, I think for DJs now, it's much harder. You feel like you're competing against an endless, almost infinite amount of DJs. Like there's a machine somewhere just generating more and more DJs and pushing them out onto social media. So yeah, it feels much more of a crowded kind of marketplace. It's much harder to stand out. There's a kind of talk of, you know, the algorithm, what you should do on your Instagram post to make it pop with the algorithm, make it get in front of a lot of people. And then, yeah, it's just harder. It's just, I think it's much harder. I think local scenes and certain musical trends used to grow organically. Now, if someone does something original and it gets a great reaction and that's put on Instagram on a Monday morning, by the next weekend, 1,000 DJs could be doing the same thing. And that could be a musical thing, or it could be a certain way of performing. You see these kind of trends. Someone does something, a few other people do it, and then because their videos go viral, everyone else is doing it. And I think it's harder to stand out. It's harder to be yourself. And I think it's much harder to start a career. If someone asked me, like, how would you start as a brand new DJ and producer with zero followers, zero releases? I think it's much harder to start than when I began. Even though there were more barriers of entry up when I began, if you actually, you know, networked and got somewhere, I think you had a good chance of breaking through. And now you can have releases that everyone's playing, you can have a fairly good social media kind of profile, and still you can't turn it into a full-time career. Yeah, it's hard. It's really hard.
Yeah, and at the same time, we look at somebody who is successful in different metrics. Of course, there's different parts and ways in which you can be successful. And then we see one part and then we say, okay, this is the one exact reason why things are happening, when in reality, life is complex. And there's, 1,000 reasons that brought this one result.
Yeah, you can't just judge other people that way. There's people that play 10 gigs a month when they're starting off, but they're very low paid gigs. The agency is pushing them into every gig that they can get on, just so it gives the impression that they're busy. And they are busy. They're traveling and playing these gigs, but not making a lot of money. Some people are even playing gigs at a loss because they're paying for their own, say, flight to the gig. They get a small fee, but that might not cover their costs. But it's about building profile. It's about looking like you've got a busy schedule. Obviously, if you're playing gigs, you can film your performances. You're building up content to use for social media. So in some ways, that's a fairly sensible strategy. It's investing in yourself. But in other ways, it's playing 10 gigs a month and not earning that much. You're really sort of breaking your back to try and get somewhere. And you can do it for a while, but after a bit, it's hard, you know. And even someone of my experience, there's some countries that I haven't played very often where my agent will say, like, this is going to be you're going to play for a lower fee, but it's, it's trying to establish you in a different territory. And then you have to decide if you want to sort of do that and work quite hard for a much smaller payment with a hope that it will grow into something else in the future.
And for your artistic profile, do you sit down, let's say, once every year or once every 6 months, and sit down and say, okay, this is kind of my strategy. This is where I want to take my label. This is where I want to take my profile, and then slowly work on it. Or you just enjoy making music day by day, weekend by weekend, and you just go with the flow, so to speak?
With the label, firstly, yeah, there's a definite plan. Like last year, apart from one release, it was all music by me. I was not even accepting demos from artists that are established on my label. I just wanted to focus on myself, focus on my album that came out in March. This year, it's the label's open again to releasing music from other artists. So that's been planned for a while, and there's a lot of releases coming, which is why there's more releases this year. For me, myself, I don't really have a plan for my DJ, and it's not like within 2 years I want to be at this festival or I want to be making an average of so much money per gig. But yeah, for my music, I know what labels I want to work with this year that I'm in discussion with. I know what I want to do on Pert Tracks. But we'll just see. You know, I could get an email after this call now that could like completely change my plan. Someone could say, a label I'd never thought about working with could say, we love you, can you do an EP? And then I would like have to shift things around, cancel things. So yeah, it's always up for grabs. But yeah, I'm always happy to like work. I work to my plan, and if a surprise happens, then yeah, I find a way to fit that in with everything else.
And is there like an interesting story where you planned something and then it didn't go as you planned, and then as a result was something a lot more positive from your past?
No, well, maybe I won't name labels, but it's been labels that have signed tracks of mine and they have just kept saying, oh, there's a delay, or can you do one more track for the EP, or can you change something about one of the tracks we signed? One label, it went on for 2.5 years, this thing. And by the time it got to the end of the 2.5 years, I was really sick of the tracks because they'd been through lots of changes. Then the label sort of disappeared on me, like they weren't replying to emails. And I wrote them not a rude email, but just quite like, I need an answer. But just, you even just reply yes or no. Is this release going to happen in the next 6 months? Or for whatever reason, you don't want to do it. And they just wrote back to me, really sorry, we're not going to go ahead with it. And then I went back to the earlier versions of the tracks, which are the ones that were most true to my original kind of vision of the tracks, and immediately put them on Perk Tracks. I didn't want to go through the process of signing them again. And they did really well. So I think they did better on Perk Tracks because I could completely control how they were promoted and released than onto this other label. But yeah, that happens quite a lot. Like that's one of the main reasons of having your own label, that you're not getting messed about by other labels and they're not sitting on your tracks for 2 years and then not releasing them. Because that can really slow down your career and your growth, but it could also, like, creatively, you want your music to come out sequentially in the order that you finish the tracks. You don't want to, you know, you do a new single and then the next thing, without any warning, something you did 2 years ago is released and marketed as your new single. So yeah, it's to have total control and not work with other labels is a good thing, definitely. And I've learned that the hard way, I think.
Okay, and why is it important that your tracks are coming out sequentially in the order that you are producing them? Why is that important?
Because I like to believe that I'm progressing with my music, and it's not getting better. It's hard to say each track is better than the last one, but stylistically and conceptually, I think they follow a kind of a path. A sort of route forward. So yeah, something I make now, if that comes out and then something from a few months ago comes out after it, that's fine. But if it's a case of years, then any artist, you would hope in a space of a few years that you would hope their music has developed enough that it would sound different to what they're doing in the current day. So yeah, you just want there to be a sort of linear progression in your music that people can hear. And if they go to something like Beatport or Bandcamp, and they can see all your releases and they went through them, you know, from the earliest releases to the most recent, they can just see a kind of progression and maybe a bit more sort of confidence in the tracks as well and things like that. And yeah, if they're released out of sequence too much, I think it becomes a bit of a mess.
In my research, I saw that you started working at a company called Prime. They were distributing vinyl. Is that correct? Can you tell us a story about that and how it affected you now running a label? What did you learn?
Okay, so when I was a student, I did work experience at a place, a record label, and they offered me a job. They said, as soon as you finish university, get in touch and we'll give you a job. So I called up that company as soon as I finished and said, can I have my job now? And they said, oh no, we've had some financial problems. We've actually had to let some staff leave the company, but the guy you're working with has now gone to Prime. So his name is Max. So I said, call Max and see what he can do. I spoke to Max and he said, oh, yes, I've been offered the chance to take on an assistant. Come and talk to the bosses and you can have that job. So I started working at Prime. So Prime was a distribution company based in the west of London, very near Wembley Stadium, near the football stadium, if you know that. And It distributed, I don't know how many labels, a few, like 200 or 300 labels, the exclusive worldwide distributor of these labels. And then also we would import like hot records from, say, the USA or Germany, and we'd sell them to these shops in the UK. So we'd act as an importer for like these big hits from other countries. There was about 60 staff there. So there's a big warehouse on the ground floor and then the management offices on the first floor up. So I was in the management office and I started off doing a few different jobs and being assistant to the head of publishing, because we had a publishing division looking after licensing and syncs and compilation licensing. Compilation licensing used to be a much bigger industry than it is now, you know, licensing tracks to DJ mixes and things like that. And then after a bit, I got moved to be the head of the labels. So Prime distributed other people's vinyl, but we also had 5 or 6 of our own labels, which was Primate is probably the most famous label, Primeval. A house label called Primary. We had a sort of more progressive tribal label called Premier Sounds. So the boss, John, would do the A&R. He would speak to the artists, a lot of whom were friends of his. He would sign the tracks. And then once he signed them, it was passed over to me to master the tracks, manufacture them, do the promotion and all this stuff. So, yeah, I worked at Prime. And the kind of artists we were working with back then, like Adam Beyer, Ben Sims, Chris Liebing. Yeah, all that Christian Smith, that kind of generation of techno DJs. And because a lot of them were still playing vinyl in their DJ sets on a Thursday or Friday, any DJs that were playing in London that weekend would come to the office, go through the warehouse, you know, help themselves to the newest records, get the white labels, like the unreleased things. So yeah, it was a great environment to be around. I was still making music at this time, but I was very shy and I wasn't playing it to people. I was keeping it to myself. So, but it was just good to make these contacts, you know, like when I first signed to Drum Code, when I first signed to CLR, I was able to say like, oh, you might not remember me, but I was the guy at Prime that, you know, would give you the records and things like that. And I was not someone that, if someone came into Prime, which was my day job, I wouldn't then try and transform it into an opportunity to give them a demo, because I think that would annoy my bosses and seem getting in the face of the DJs. But yeah, I'd always try and be polite, and there'd be some socializing, going out for meals or go to the events they played at in London. So yeah, it was a really good way of building up contacts, learning a lot about music. I was a vinyl DJ at this time. So yeah, it was amazing to have however many records in the warehouse. I don't know, hundreds of thousands of records in the warehouse. So yeah, it was a really good time, really good way of making contacts. And then in about, I think it was 2002, when I'd been there about 2 years, 3 years, the company went bankrupt, sadly, due to a number of reasons. And yeah, so that was the end of my time at Prime.
So you still learned a lot, met a lot of new people, you saw how the business works.
Yeah, I learned everything about releasing vinyl records, about compilation licensing and the kind of sort of legal business side of it, contracts, things like that. Yeah, it was good. You know, I had access to all like the sales data for different labels to see how many records they'd sold that month, you know, things like that. So I had a lot of information at my fingertips, which I could learn from. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. It's good. And after that, I worked for a series of labels. So to have an underground music vinyl distributor with 60 people working at it, it now is like unheard of. You know, someone like Triple Vision in the Netherlands, I have no idea how many staff they have, 5, 10, maybe 15 maximum. But like to have 60 people only selling techno, we did a tiny bit of house, but that was the rest of it was techno. To have like 60 people, full-time employees selling techno is, yeah, crazy. It wouldn't happen now.
Okay, that sounds huge.
Yeah, it was
sounds
big.
Really big.
Yeah, it was good times, but
and you saw a lot of the paperwork that is done behind the scenes, a lot of contracting and publishing. What would you advise?
advice on that side. With contracts, if you're signing to a label, never sign for perpetuity or like forever. Some labels will say we want to sign your track until the end of time. Like, never do that. Try and keep it relatively short. You know, back in those days, labels would try and offer you a seven-year deal, and you could normally negotiate them down to, say, 5 years. But these days, with the way things are, I would, yeah. If you think a track's going to be a hit, but you do want to sign it to another label, then, yeah, maybe 3 years, something like that, with a clause to negotiate again. And, yeah, and just learning about how royalties work, how back then you'd get paid for the vinyl sales, but you'd also get paid for, like, yeah, compilation licensing. And now it's even more complex because you've got vinyl sales, streaming income, download sales, different platforms. So, yeah. It's very complex, but just keeping an eye on like what you're being offered and how it works, and taking the time to read a contract. Yeah, I learned all that stuff. But then again, these days, a lot of stuff is not even contracted. Like, there's nothing. Someone says, oh, I'll release your two tracks. You send them the files, they release it, which is fine until something becomes a big hit. And then you haven't got any kind of payment, you know, structure or a royalty split in place. You haven't got, if it gets licensed to another label, which still happens occasionally, you haven't got anything in place for how that's going to be dealt with. So yeah, it gets very messy. So with pert tracks, often when an artist joins a label for the first time, there'll be contracts. And then if we become more like friends and they want to do more in the future, then there's sometimes not contracts, but obviously the terms of the original contract are assumed to kind of carry through for the future releases.
And how important are, when we are releasing the music, this is one side is the technical, the royalties that we explained right now, and the other side can be marketing. How much do you focus on marketing pre-release, and let's say how much after the release?
I generally try and build it up pre-release. I don't do really long campaigns. Like the Million record, which is up there. The Million record, which came out last week, I think was announced 10 days before release. There's six tracks on the record. So three tracks were kind of put online in that sort of 10-day period, one every 3 days or so. And then the record came out. And yeah, it's really hard online because you don't want to just keep spamming people. You don't just put up the same picture of the record and say, it's out now, here's the Bandcamp link. If you do that, you're just going to, people are going to shut off when they see it. They might unfollow you or put you on mute because it's just boring. So it's quite hard to kind of keep selling something. You need kind of fresh content, whether it's in the video or a video for one of the tracks, or a video of a DJ playing it out, or some kind of a review maybe, or a feedback. Yeah, you have to keep pushing. It's really hard because there's just more out there with the way you can release music digitally. Everyone's releasing. There's people that are having a release almost every week now. So yeah, it's a fine line for me at Perk Tracks between keeping a record alive after it's released and trying not to spam people and annoy them and stuff, because that's pointless as well.
And how do you keep a track alive, you mentioned?
Just keep posting, but try and post about it from different angles, not just the same image or the same video over and over again. If I've got video of me or any other DJs playing it in a set, I'll put that in a folder. I have a folder for every release on my computer, so that goes in the folder, and then slowly they'll get put online as and when I need them, you know. So there's the next release on Perk Tracks, which is out at the start of March. There's videos of me playing those tracks from the last year or so. But I played the gigs, I didn't put those videos online. I put videos of me playing other tracks. So I'm sitting on those videos for when the campaign starts for that release. And then I know I've got like 4 or 5 bits of content, which will, you know, help promote that video, help promote that release. And then it's more exciting. A video of me playing a track is more exciting than just, you know, a photo of the vinyl or something. So yeah, it's hard. And obviously, if it's a release by another artist, I try to keep them. I try to keep them involved, and I would rather they did their own posts about why, from a sort of personal point of view, like they'll talk about how they made the tracks, what it means to them to release on Perk Tracks. Things like that are much better coming directly from the artist rather than me just doing a post from the Pertrax perspective, and then adding them as a collaborator, and they just click yes. You know, that works, but it's much better if it's the artists themselves is talking like from the heart.
So it's good to have that distribution from different channels, not just from the label.
Yeah, of course, because obviously between the Pertrax account and another artist account, there will be some crossover of followers and people, of course, because we're all in a very similar area of techno. But yeah, you'd hope they'll somehow reach different people. I know some, or just even everyone has a different way of posting. Some people are better at social media than others, whether that's natural or they've taken some time to sort of learn social media strategy. But yeah, I think as many people as you can have talking about a release, the more the merrier, really. And yeah, having the artists talk about it, just I think it comes across better. If a label's telling you about a release, it comes across much more as buy this, buy this, buy this. When if it's an artist, as I said, they can talk about it from a personal point of view, and it become hopefully that content is more interesting than just the label shoving something in your face and telling you to buy it.
And do you see today that releases are supporting an artist's career in the touring sense as much as they did in the past, for example? Or can we say that the social media creating hype is just took over a whole nother dimension?
Yeah, I think the social media thing is the big one now. I think there used to be a definite link between releasing music and getting bookings, and whilst that is not completely finished, it's kind of almost completely, it's almost broken. Like there's nothing wrong with releasing music. People enjoy making music. That's one of the reasons why they do it. So if you enjoy making it and you release it, that's great. But unless you're one of the few big hits of the year, I think just releasing music is not going to guarantee you a full schedule of gigs. It's really hard. It's really hard. But then again, I always think that there's no reason why someone that makes good music should be a great DJ. So like years ago, people would book people that have made like 5 hot records in a row. They might have never heard a DJ mix from this person because this is a pre-internet or early internet time, and then they would turn up at the club and could barely mix, or they could mix, but their kind of choice of records is very kind of just the big hits, very obvious. There's no kind of depth to their sets. So yeah, so this idea that producers should be rewarded with gigs is a great thing, but there's no guarantee. In the same way, someone that looks good, someone that can take a good photo of themselves on social media, there's no guarantee they'll be a good DJ. There's no guarantee that a good producer can be a good DJ. And there's lots of artists where I could say, okay, they're a better DJ than producer, and vice versa. And for myself, obviously, I try and be the best of both, but I'm sure different people have different opinions on what I do better or worse.
And let's say a hypothetical situation, if you had to choose one, let's say from tomorrow on, you have to be only a producer, or from tomorrow, you can only be a live performer. What would you choose?
I think it's really hard to say. I would probably say a producer, because I started off as a producer. I always wanted to release music and make music. The DJing kind of came later. If I could be at home and I was like 80 or 90 years old and still making music and still enjoying making it and still feeling like I'm progressing artistically or technically with my music, then I'd be happy, you know? And these days, even if no one was buying your music, you could still release it with it. You could still put it on Bandcamp or whatever the equivalent of Bandcamp is in the future. You could still put it on Beatport. You could still put it on YouTube and SoundCloud. So you can still get your music out there. And yeah, I love being in the studio. I love seeing where a certain studio session will take me, and you know, the surprises that come up. I never make the track I'm expecting to make when I go into the studio. And then on the other side of it, like DJing, I love DJing. I've done it for quite a long time. I've been very lucky with the number of years I've had a really busy touring schedule for. And I love seeing people and the reaction and all that. And I would miss that a lot. But when you release music, in theory, it's there forever. It's online forever. You know, the internet could die and all music could disappear from online. But I don't think it will. So like the music is there. And it, in theory, it should last forever, or even if, whether someone has it physically or digitally. When with DJing, the event happens, it's finished, and the memories live on, but it doesn't remain in the same way that sort of music exists in, going into the future, if that makes any sense.
Yes, of course, of course. And what do gigs, for example, mean to you? I'm not sure if I ask this already, but let's say you come home after a very long weekend. It's Sunday night. You're completely drained, but then you lay into your bed or sit on the couch. And what's that feeling that says, okay, let's do it again in 5 weeks, days?
Well, whatever type of gig I have, I always want to do it again. If it's a gig where I feel like I played well but didn't play my absolute best, I want to. It's like if you had a football match where you didn't play your best, you want to go straight out and do it again to kind of erase the memory of that performance, that where you were only at maybe 80 or 90% of your best. So I always want to go back out gigging. And if it's a great gig, of course, you want to just get out there and experience that again, and the feedback and the reaction from the crowd and the energy. And that's the thing about a good event, a good DJ gig. It should be an exchange of energy between the crowd and the DJ. If the place isn't that full, or the crowd aren't reacting as you expect or something, then yeah, it's you just have to keep giving your all and doing the best you can. But those really magical nights where everything is perfect, the venue, the sound, the lights, the people, your own performance, then that's better than anything. That's just like, that's the best experience you can have. And that could be 100, 200 people, or it could be thousands. It's not about the number of people. It's about the kind of connection you make. Even if it's a temporary connection for 1 or 2 hours, it's still something special that happened. And it's easy to think, oh, okay, on to the next weekend. But for the people that were there, in theory, they should remember it forever.
And is there like an early event that you were when you were younger, like after the university you mentioned, when you started then working at Prime? Was there a certain event which you can point out that you would like to return, let's say with the time machine, and relive the night again?
Oh, wow. I'm trying to think. Yeah, well, it probably would have been my early gigs were in the UK. Of course, I'm based here. So I started off playing in London, and then I started off playing in places like Manchester, Birmingham, Liverpool, up to Scotland. So, yeah, I think some of those early gigs in London, I started off more as a kind of after party DJ. So I'd play on a Saturday evening, early in the Saturday evening, for people that are still awake from the Friday night. So those were great days. I remember those. And like, they felt really kind of carefree, because I've never been like super confident in myself, and I've never had some great career plan. And back then there wasn't this career path that social media has given DJs now. So I was just enjoying each weekend as it came. I used to do my own bookings. I used to have this little like a notepad, and I'd write down the promoter's phone number and email address and the conditions of the booking. I still have them. I still have the booking diaries. So, okay. Yeah.
You can send us a photo.
Yeah, I'll try and find them. Yeah, send them in. And it says like, no, I won't say the amounts, but it says, do not accept any gig under this amount of money. And then a few months later, when I feel like I've progressed a bit, I change the amount like by another like 50 or 100 pounds, do not accept. Because obviously, especially when you're a new DJ, and this still happens now, when you're a new DJ, there's people that are saying, oh, will you play for free, or will you play for like a tiny amount of money? And like, you have to have some level of sort of self-respect and self-worth. But yeah, going back, yeah, those early gigs were just, yeah, like every weekend, because I was sort of raving and partying more, every weekend felt like it would go on forever. Like the weekend was like 3 days, and I was still working a full-time job. And the gigs were like generally small, but you had a lot of friends there. It was just, yeah, they were just a kind of special feeling about them. I wasn't playing big events back then. And if I was, like the first time I played a festival in the Netherlands, I played for a drum code showcase at a festival in the Netherlands. I think it was the first time I played in the Netherlands, but I was like the first DJ on. Like when they opened the gates of the festival at midday, I was the first DJ on, so I played to no one. By the end of my set, there was like 50 people in a kind of arena that could hold 10,000. So, like, yeah, my foreign gigs, my international gigs, weren't so special because I was at the bottom of the lineup, and it was trying to build some profile in these places. But the London gigs, especially where I had a bit more profile when I was younger, the London gigs, where I first sort of started to get a crowd and sort of recognition of what I did. Yeah, back then they were great. There's a place called Public Life that I've spoken about before, which was a sort of after party venue in East London. And yeah, that was just crazy. Yeah, it's sadly it's closed down now. But like you used to get people like me and Dax J would play there, Rebecca would play there when we were all like just tiny little people. Yeah.
And when you played that first international show in the Netherlands, I understood correctly, on the drum code event, what was going through your head? Let's say when you were playing practically to yourself, what was going through your head?
If I remember rightly, I was still playing vinyl. The main thing really was I wasn't thinking so much of the crowd. I knew it wouldn't be that busy because even if when the festival gates open, even if everyone pours in, it's still going to take them half an hour, 1 hour to kind of get to the, you know, get a drink, put their bag somewhere, get to the arena. I think because Adam was there, Adam Bayer was there. I think I was just trying to mix well, just like mix, just a solid mix. It's a warm up set. You don't have to like blow the roof off the place. You just had to like get from one track to the other, build up the vibe, not make mistakes, not do really horrible out of time mixes. And like the one thing you learn when you go from being, you can be the best vinyl DJ in the world in your bedroom or in your lounge, but once you're on a different sound system, a different environment, anything can happen. Like sometimes everything just clicks into place. And I used to play great vinyl sets, and other times you just, even though the sound was good, for some reason you just couldn't get your mixes to sit nicely. So yeah, my main thing I was apprehensive about are those early gigs for bigger events was just mixing a sort of solid, good set. Not trying to be the star of the day, not trying to like do anything really special, but just be sort of solid and dependable and earn your kind of right to be there.
And do you think we as a crowd and also artists, when they perform, do you think the warm-up slot is undervalued?
Yeah, this is something people talk about a lot at the moment. And the art of a good warm-up set, it's not dead, but it's not so appreciated. A lot of people, this happens, people can be playing a very small place, like a bar or something, and it's their first ever gig, and their friends are there. They're gonna record it. Maybe they're gonna have their friends filming with their phones, and they treat it like, you know, closing set at Awakenings. They're like playing like super fast, big banging tracks, really long breakdowns. The kind of thing that doesn't really work in a small venue. And it's like it's all about getting content. It's all about sort of showing you what they would do if they were playing a peak time set at a big festival, when before, in like a while ago, people would just their thing would be just to play a good set it up for the next DJ and make sure there's some kind of like linear progression through the event, from the opening DJs to the mid DJs who are going to bring the energy up a bit, and then the final DJs that are going to play a bit harder, and yeah, the closing sets. But yeah, that's kind of gone, and it's I really like it when I get to a gig. And it doesn't matter about the age of the DJ, but where they're playing something interesting, a kind of warm-up set. And it can be, you can play fast, but, you know, but not super hard. You can play fast and energetic, but still quite kind of light on its toes, I would say. You know, I played in Scotland a few years ago, and the person before me, I didn't know who they were, and they were playing at 110 BPM, like dub techno. And the crowd liked it, and it was amazing. It meant that when I came on, I started my set a bit slower, not at 110, but slower than I normally would, and it gave me the chance to build up. And it was just nice to have that kind of just something different to work with. If I'm coming on after someone playing at 160, even at 170 I've had in the past, it's really hard for me to come on. I'm not going to match that tempo. So I'm having to drop the tempo but keep the energy up, and it's, yeah. I think that kind of thing, maybe with what's happening with hard techno at the moment, I think that will slowly fade out a bit. But it's still a problem to have someone playing the crazy fast sets before the next DJ here.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, maybe better to have two or three DJs less on the lineup and really give everybody like a space to perform and to develop their own story, whether that's in the middle of the night or at the start of the night.
Yeah, there has to be a balance there. If I always think that a DJ should do some research and see who's playing after them, maybe just skip, not even listen to a whole mix, but just skip through their most recent mixes on SoundCloud and just get an idea what they play. And then, of course, you don't have to play what they play, but just play something that's kind of complementary and can work with them. Even if you play exactly the set you want, and then the last 10 or 15 minutes, you somehow bend a little bit towards what could work for them. Because, yeah, this is not such a belief. This belief is not held so much today. But like a set and a night should kind of flow and should be a night of music, not a showcase for four DJs to do their own individual thing. Like I remember when all the DJs would mix into each other. That used to be a thing. So, you know, someone would put their last track on, they'd kind of step back a bit from the equipment and you'd step forward, their track would still be playing, and you'd mix in something that was complementary, and then you'd stop their track, they would go away and you'd kind of keep going. But like a few years ago, I mixed into someone a bit younger than me, I mixed into their last track and they couldn't believe it. They were because for them, I had stolen their moment of getting applause, putting their hands in the air, saying thank you. That had been erased because I mixed in that my first track, and then my second track came in. I took out the USB stick and gave it to them, and they looked at me like I'd stolen their, you know, their special moment. So I would prefer DJs to mix into each other, but I think the way social media is, people want their allotted moment and they want it to be filmed, and it's a different consideration these days.
Mm. And also the closing at the same time. Probably you have to think about how you do it, go with the flow, see what was played before you.
Yeah, that's another thing. Like if you're playing at 4 a.m, I wouldn't expect the DJ to get to the club at 10 or 11 p.m. You want to be there for 5 hours before you play. But the DJs that turn up like 5 minutes before they play, they haven't had a chance to kind of gauge the kind of atmosphere and the vibe of the club. Also, sometimes if there's one really hot techno track at the time, you know, if DJs aren't hearing much of the other DJ sets, you end up hearing the same track 3 times through the night. Because there was that track, Push It, that track a few years ago, and you'd hear multiple DJs play that through the night. I think people maybe have their sets not pre-recorded, they're not pre-recording sets, but pre-planned. So they have a rough idea of what tracks they're going to play. So if someone plays a track in their set, which is key to your set, for me, I wouldn't play it. I'd be like, okay, someone's played that already. We're done. I'll play it next week. It's cool. But for other people, if they're building their set around that track, they have to play it for their set to work. So that's to do with flexibility as well. But it's definitely worth hearing what the DJ is playing before you. You can actually learn from other DJs, both listening to them and also especially watching them, because you're lucky enough to be in the booth and seeing what they're doing. You're not on the dance floor. So you can actually see what they're doing with their hands, how they're mixing, how they're managing the set. But people just want to turn up 5 minutes before their set, plug in, play, and then leave, really. It's a different kind of mindset. Most DJs, including me, were started as clubbers. So therefore, you should want to be in the club environment, you know, not for 8 hours a night, especially if you're doing 2 or 3 gigs that weekend, but you should enjoy being around DJs and sound systems and music. And therefore, you should be interested in what other people are doing, not just rocking up, playing your set and leaving. But everyone's different. So, yeah.
Yeah. And that's an interesting story that popped into my head when you mentioned multiple DJs playing the same song throughout the night. I was in Slovenia, where I'm originally from. There used to be a club, Ambasada Gavioli. I suppose you heard about it. And yeah, there was the last party, which then, of course, was not the last party, but it was marketed as the last. And Jeff Mills' Bells, it came, I think, like 4 or 5 times. Everybody played it. And it was like the second time, okay, this can happen. And the third time was, okay, is this a joke?
Yeah, it's mad. You used to get that a lot. There's less, this is a whole different conversation, but there's less techno hits these days, like the really big tracks. You get them occasionally, but like years ago, they used to be much more frequent, and like a track like Knights of the Jaguar, you'd hear multiple times through a night, the bells, things like this. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. Going back to Slovenia, I remember, I think Umek used to talk about people playing his biggest tracks just before he comes on. So he's actually in the booth. Like, and the DJ before them is sometimes playing them as a kind of tribute. They're like, I'm playing your track because I love the track and I love you as a DJ. But then Umek is like, well, that's like, that's a track I released 2 weeks ago. It's doing really well. You know, it'd be nice if I could play that. Yeah. The first ever time I had a hit, which in inverted commas, was my track Up on Compact. And I played in Paris and someone played it as their last track before I came on. And it was nice. And it's nice that they it was on vinyl. They'd bought the vinyl. They were playing it. It was you know, it's a kind of a show of respect to me and to the track. But at the same point, I was like, eh. I'm playing a 90-minute set. Do I play it in 90 minutes' time at the end of my set? But I didn't. I just let it go. But I remember that. It was a strange situation.
Mm-hmm. You had to let it go, and you know.
Yeah, I didn't play it. I let it go. I didn't speak. It's not about being angry with the person. It's just sort of consideration. Like I often, if I'm playing with a DJ in another country who's maybe younger and starting off, it's quite nice. If I know their music, I'll try and play something of theirs, just to show that I'm aware of what they do. And I think it's nice. It's nice to show some support and respect to them. But it wouldn't be like their latest release. It'd be something maybe from like a year ago that something that I've been playing, just to kind of, yeah, it's just a nice thing to do. But I wouldn't play someone's big track just before they come on, because yeah, it's weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can steal the moment, just like the guy who was surprised when you mixed the track. It was like not.
Yeah. Yeah. He couldn't believe it. Yeah.
Prepared. So I want to go back just a little bit when we were speaking about touring and the bookings. And I'm interested in what's your opinion of what is like a good stage where an artist can think about of getting an agency. Because I think a lot of artists think that they're like entitled to a lot of gigs, and they think that, oh, I just need an agent and then my career will suddenly magically open up. What's your view on that?
I would think it depends how good you are communicated with people, how willing you are to kind of get in touch with people directly, and how happy you are negotiating things like money. And it's much harder to negotiate a fee for yourself than it is to negotiate a fee for a DJ you represent, or like a friend or something like that. The trend these days is for people to get agents much sooner in their career. Like as I said, when I used to do my bookings in my diaries, I must have done that for sort of three or four years with doing like four or five gigs a month. So it's quite a busy thing to keep on top of. But a lot of people think that getting a good agent will sort of unlock gigs for them. Somehow an agent can magic gigs like a wizard. But there's no like secret formula. If the demand isn't out there, the agent can hit up their contacts and say, look, we've got this new artist, we really believe in him, can you give them a gig, try something out? But that doesn't work that often. If it does, it's going to be a very low paying gig, just where the promoter's almost doing it as a favor to the agency rather than being impressed or being interested in booking the person. So yeah, an agent isn't going to help you suddenly get really busy, but a good agent can be very, very beneficial. A bad agent can be very detrimental to your career. If you've got an agent that's being, say, you know, rude or disrespectful to promoters, or is ignoring emails, then obviously that can be detrimental to your career. I don't know when the optimum time would be. I would personally say, where if we're assuming the DJ we're talking about is also a producer, then a good time to get an agent is when the work, the administration and the communication work you're doing to organize your gigs is getting in the way of your time making music, your time maybe running a label, your time even preparing as a DJ. If you're spending your whole time chasing up flights, hotels, booking fees, deposits, then yeah, it's when it gets in the way. Like my first agent was based in the Netherlands, but they were only doing the Netherlands for me. So I started getting busier there. I took on an agent in the Netherlands and I kept the UK, which was mainly London at that point for me. I kept doing London myself because I had the better contacts there than the Dutch guys didn't have good UK contacts. And I just let the Dutch guys do the Netherlands and they built me up there. So that kind of worked for a bit. But then I organized, years ago, I organized a US tour, I think 5 gigs in the USA. and organized it completely myself, trying to get all the promoters to work together. And it did happen. Of the five gigs, four of them happened. One was cancelled while I was on the tour. But I just remember it was so much work. I projected sort of how much money I was going to make, and I made a lot less because there were a lot of extra costs came in that I hadn't been aware of. Whatever. And that was the point where I even though it was great to see the States, and it was one of my first times going there, it was just, okay, this is the time to hand this over to somebody else, someone with a bit more experience, a bit more kind of weight, because obviously if you're with an agency and they've got 15 artists, the promoter has to treat one artist with respect. Otherwise, the agency will stop doing bookings completely and the promoter will lose access to all those 15 artists. So it's a bit like, it's almost like a sort of workers union. You have a little bit more kind of solidarity and kind of people around you to give you a bit of muscle if you're with an agency. If you're completely on your own, then yeah, I think you're more open to not just being ripped off, but if you're representing yourself, you're more open to just not being treated with the most respect, which, yeah, it's a lot harder representing yourself.
And how do you view this professional relationship with your agent, let's say today? How do you divide your responsibilities, both, let's say, aiming to pushing your profile? You have to work on releases, and the agent has to work on, let's say, pitching you or following up with everything. How do you view your relationship now?
My relationship with my agent is good. I'm with Chris at Elite, who are based in Brighton in the UK. And yeah, I've been there a long time. I had one agent before Chris at the same agency. And then she left and I moved to Chris. I'm not sure when that was, 10 years with Chris, at least. Maybe it's been a long time, and there's been ups and downs in terms of bookings and things like that. Chris is almost like he's always there for, if I want to ask about something, I have an idea. Is this a good idea? Is this going to be, not many ideas I have are going to be like bad for my career, but there's somewhere he could say, well, this is going to be a whole load of work. It's going to take 6 months to complete this project. And I don't think it's really going to benefit you in terms of bookings. So I could still do that project because it would be satisfying for me in an artistic way. But he'll say, like, this is not something that's really going to register with promoters to get you more gigs. So it's almost, he's not my manager, but there's a bit of like conversation between us about career moves, you know, plans for the future. Like end of last year, he was saying, what are my plans for this year? So it works like that. Yeah, I think it's important for your agent to have good communication. I've heard horror stories of people that they only ever speak to their agent if something's cancelled. Otherwise, all they can do is check like an online diary and see where gigs go from, like, you know, an inquiry is yellow and then it gets confirmed and it changes to green and that means the gig is happening. You know, I couldn't have that. I would need this sort of communication with my agent. Like between Monday and Friday, I'll speak to my agency, but yeah, maybe two or three times during the week, whether it's emails or a quick phone call. And then about once a month, we have a longer phone call, go through gigs, go through releases, other things I have going on, and just kind of work out where I'm at and what the agency can do to help me. Because if you get to the point where you've got so, your diary is so quiet that you're calling up the agency, getting angry and stressed, like, you, as I said before, agencies can't just go, oh, he's putting pressure on us, we'll just give him five gigs. They can't magic gigs out of nowhere, you know. And if you have a time where you haven't got so many gigs, things don't normally change overnight. It's about changing what you're doing behind the scenes, and then over a period of 3 or 6 months you kind of grow again and you try and get back to the position you were maybe a year ago. So yeah, but yeah, my main point for an agent would be that there has to be that kind of two-way communication and respect, and an agent that knows what they're talking about and they can give you advice. If it's just an agent that just books you in gigs and never speaks to you, then it's much harder to kind of have a working relationship.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of new ideas, you said that you also have a lot of ideas and the agency also provides that. And do you believe that the artist should be the primary source of new ideas?
Yeah, I think an artist, well, by definition, an artist should be creative, and that's being creative in the studio, but also thinking about interesting things to do with your career. If you have your own label and you only release on that own label, and it's just EP, 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 like four EPs a year on your own label, and you're not really getting bookings and you're not breaking through, then yeah, someone's got to say, like, something needs to change. You maybe do an album, do something different, do a collaboration. Maybe try and release, it's more pressure, but maybe try and release on a different label, you know, someone else's label, hit a different kind of demographic of people or a different kind of marketplace. So yeah, an agency can advise like that. I can't think of anything, well, unless I sort of thought of something really controversial, I can't think of anything where my label would say, oh, please don't do that. That's going to be like career suicide for you. But yeah, recently we've had some talks and they have said, like, what you're doing is great, Ali, but have you considered this or that? And sometimes I'm like, oh, that's a great idea. Yeah, that's actually something I should do. And other times I'm like, yeah, I could do that, but at this point I'm not comfortable, you know, approaching that label or that organization to work with them. You know, it's as I said, it's a two-way street, definitely.
Mm-hmm. And for this year, we are now filming in February. What's something you're looking forward to in this year?
For me, really release-wise, yeah, there's more. Like last year, there was one big release for me, which was the album, The Cutoff, which came out in March last year. This year, there's no album because it's too soon. So it's going to be more like different EPs, different collaborations, different projects. So a lot more music coming out, but in kind of smaller chunks. So the next thing for me, well, I got the EP on Scaramalia's Void Plus One label, which is the remixes of Loose Fits, which is a track I released on his label a few years ago. There's new remix is coming from Scaramalia himself and Tensile, and also the version of the track that I played at Awakenings in my live set is getting released. So I think that's the first time something from a live set that I've done has been actually released. I've put a live set online before in total, but this time we cut the track out of the live set, a few edits, and it's actually going on vinyl. So it's quite interesting to release the live version of a track. You don't get a lot of techno live albums. You know, it's the thing you get in rock music a lot. But it's not an album, it's just a one track for me, but it's interesting to have something live be released. And then after that, there's going to be two EPs of remixes of tracks from my album, from The Cutoff. So they're going to be released at the start, one at the start of March, one at the end of March. So that's eight remixes, older experienced producers, brand new young producers. It's exciting to kind of reconceptualize my album in a different way and hear people's interpretations of it. So that's, yeah, the album remixes in March. And then after that, some more brand new original music from me, maybe in the summer.
Okay, so sounds very busy. Sounds strategic.
Yeah, as I said, yeah, lots. Instead of the one big album, this year's lots of sort of smaller releases, like almost a constant flow of music. It's going to be good.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell a little bit more about, you mentioned live released music. Let's say you play a track during your live set, you kind of put it out there and then you realize, okay, this section was very interesting. Maybe we can cut it out and release it.
Yeah.
How does that work?
In the past, yeah, when I play a live set, I always record it because I play a lot less live sets and DJ sets, maybe like only 3, 4, 5, maybe a year, not so many. So I always record the set so I can go back, listen to it, analyze it, see what worked well, see what maybe things that I was excited about when I prepared them, but on the day and on the gig, they didn't really somehow connect with the crowd. So I go through them. And in the past, I've listened to what I've done and taken inspiration from that. Some of the tracks from my Fire in Negative EP, which I think was about released in 2020, 2021, they were live tracks that were then recorded in the live set and developed. So it's not the live recording, but what I learned from the live set would help the development of the tracks. And on the back of the vinyl, it says, you know, inspired by the live set. I think that was another Awakenings live set. But so this is the first time where a track has been directly taken from the live set. Just a few edits to give it a proper start and ending. So mm-hmm. It's useful for DJing with. It's not just a recording. And then, yeah, it's going out. There's no crowd noise. You can't hear the crowd or anything. It sounds like it's a clean recording because I wanted to work with DJs, not just be a sort of snapshot of the live set. But yeah, I think techno live albums would be an interesting thing. Live sets don't seem to be as popular as they used to be. A few years ago when you had Ansem, and you had Karen, the Karen Project, and things like that. Live techno, and especially using modular synths, was a really big thing, and it's sort of dropped off a bit now. But yeah, like if it was someone really improvising and really creating stuff on the spot, to release that as a live album, whether it was sold or if it was just an upload on SoundCloud, I think would be really interesting. Something maybe I'll do one day, I don't know, just do 60 minutes. It'd have to be an event to have the kind of pressure and the feedback from the crowd, a 1 hour jam in the studio, I don't think would be that interesting to put up. But I think a full live set, like a live album would be, if it was somewhere, if it was a club or a festival that had a really great atmosphere, I think it'd be an interesting thing to do. And it's not something you see in techno a lot. Parallax, maybe 6 months ago, a year ago, released, I think 10 or 12 tracks cut out of a live set. So he did the same thing. He recorded them live, cut the start and ends to give them a proper intro and outro for the DJs. And he released that. But that's the first time I've seen that in a while. Yeah, I think it's something interesting. It's a new thing for techno. And it's something that definitely then it separates producers from DJs, because a DJ can't do this. So, a producer that plays live and then releases a live album would be quite an interesting concept. It happened a lot more back in the day. Not a lot, but there was a few examples of this. Yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned Parallax. Parallax is a great artist to me. I've also heard him here a lot of times. I mean, not a lot of times, but let's say 3 to 4, 5 times in Berlin. And he's slowly shifting now to, let's say, more to the house side.
Yeah, house, or yeah, it's a horrible term, but kind of groovy techno. He had his early kind of a lot of gigs and associations with sort of Cobasil's label and that kind of setup. And then I think now his sound has changed a bit more, as you say, quite housey. He's still a great, he's great playing live. He's a great DJ. Yeah, it's really interesting where he's going. You do see house coming into techno at the moment. It's quite interesting. There was the Schlaar thing in Amsterdam last week. He was playing all night long. I think it was at Warehouse Elementstraat. He was playing all night long, but he brought in Ryan Elliott and Faddy Moim to play back-to-back sets. And I think he played some night time just playing on his own as well. And the clips from that, especially from the start of the night, because it was a long event, at the start were pretty much just straight up kind of Berlin house, also kind of US house, that kind of New York, New Jersey kind of house sound is coming in. So that's interesting, because with the way hard techno has dominated techno for the last few years, those influences have been completely, they've vanished. Apart from people sampling old, maybe the vocals from house records, that's the only thing that's kind of come across. But the groove and the space and the feeling that's in a good house record, that disappeared from techno for a few years. And if it comes back, then that's interesting, you know. It's good. It's an influence that hasn't been there for a while.
Yeah, that back-to-back you mentioned from last week, I also saw it on social media. It was very interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think even though he was playing the whole night on his own or back-to-back, I think he obviously had kind of almost scheduled the night. So how it would progress from house to techno. And it's interesting. It's what we're talking about. He's almost warming up for himself, like setting the tone for the event before maybe the more energetic, the more intense techno comes later on. Yeah, I thought it was an interesting thing to do. And it completely differentiates himself from the kind of wave of hard techno that is still popular now.
And do you see yourself doing like a similar back-to-back, let's say, with somebody from different genre that could be interesting for you?
Yeah, I would like to. I think back when back-to-backs work well, it's when they're a collaboration between two people, even if you're coming from slightly different places. If you're influencing what each other plays on the night, then that's great. If you're both trying to pull the sets in different directions, then it can sound horrible. You know, if each DJ plays is unrelated to the one before it, then it's like you're both playing like two sort of separate jukeboxes. It's not good. And that's happened to me occasionally, but I think a good back-to-back, I can create something that's more than the two DJs separately. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, Ellie, I went through all of my questions I had so far.
Okay.
I also want to be respectful to your time, 1 hour 15. Maybe just you have any final thoughts for the listeners or anything like that?
Not really. We talked about the releases I've got coming up, and you know, it's easy to say just random things like just believe in yourself and be yourself. But yeah, like that's the best thing. Be yourself. focus on your own music, focus on being creative. It's a marathon, not a sprint. You don't have to be playing the world's biggest festival by next summer. You know, take things at your own pace. And in terms of production, I always say just find your own sound. Everyone's making music with sample packs and these sounds. You hear the same loops, the same kick drums over and over again. This is something that really bugs me out. Just do, if you hear someone else doing something, that should inspire you to do something different, not just to say, oh, that's a good idea, I'll copy it. And at the moment, I'm getting sent so many like releases, compilations, 30 tracks of hard groove techno, percussive techno, whatever you want to call it. And it's just all, how can 30 artists all have the same production sound? You know, years ago, every producer was so recognizable by their sound, and now everyone is very generic. And people, there's new, it's not a young and old thing. There's young producers that are making great music and really stick out. But like, if you're just gluing together samples from a sample pack, like you're putting together a Lego kit, then you can't expect to sound individual, and then you're not going to break through in any way. So it's something that's been on my mind a little while, this kind of sample pack, sort of almost painting by numbers kind of techno. And you hear it across every type of techno. It's not just hard groove or whatever. You hear it in hard techno as well. But it's something I feel strongly about, because I want more, even more than the club scene and the events, I want the music itself to progress and go forward, whether that's me doing it or I'm nothing to do with it and it's younger people doing it. And for that, you need your own sound, and you need to take time just to build things up yourself and not just take the easy route out. So there you go. Random little rant there, but yeah.
Yeah, of course. I think whatever I would add, wouldn't top it. I think it's a good message, good ending. And when's the next time you're in Berlin, if you know?
I don't know. It's something being discussed for July at the moment, but that's still quite a long way away. So I would hope I can get there maybe March or April, and then do the July one as well. I'm normally there 3 or 4 times a year. So I would think generally for me in Berlin at the moment, it's RSO or Tresor. So I think one of those in the next few months is possible. Yeah. But we'll keep in touch. It'd be great to see you there.
Yes, of course. It would be a big pleasure.
Good.
Cool.
Yeah, I hope to see you soon.
Thank you very much for the conversation. Thanks for today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. It was good. I enjoyed it.